Thank you for plugging into this Family Life News podcast, streaming issues-driven, family-focused news.
Faith Under Fire. Each Thursday on Family Life, we give voice to religious battlegrounds in this nation. I'm your host, Tracy Lynn. With us today, Adam Carrington, Associate Professor of Politics at Hillsdale College. So President Biden has been in office just over 3 months, and while executive actions are not new, he certainly started his administration with an astonishing number of executive orders. First of all, Adam, would you give us kind of a civics refresher about the division of powers or checks and balances intended by having three distinct branches of government?
Yes, the Constitution is based on the rule of law, not human beings, but what it decided and what the founders understood was that there are three functions that each need to be working to make law rule. There's the legislative, writing the laws in the first place. There's the executive power, which is enforcing those laws after they're written. And then finally, judicial, which is ultimately resolving disputes about what the law means and how it's supposed to be applied. And the rule is we have one branch each created to exercise one specific power. Now, where checks and balances come in is that there are a limited set of exceptions where one branch is given a little bit of the power of another in order to protect against encroachment. The president signing and vetoing bills would be one example. That's a legislative power. But the rule is we've separated them. The exception is anything else.
I think many of us may be confused about what weight an executive order or action carries. Does it carry the same binding power as a law, for instance?
Well, it's not the same as a law. That would obviously be Congress's job. But it does carry the force of enforcing the law. And what I mean by that is the president is given the power as the executive to enforce the law, but he can't do it alone. And therefore, part of his power in the Constitution is to take care that the laws be faithfully executed. That means he's overseeing other executive officers actually carrying out the law. And what executive orders are meant to be is a way of the president doing so. It's the president, when done rightly, telling subordinates how he understands the law and how he expects it to be enforced. And so therefore, it's not a law, but it is a carrying out of the law using the official power of the president. And as long as it's carrying out the law as written, it really is an effective way of making sure the president stays in charge of his branch. It's only a problem when he might use it, as has been done in the past, to bypass Congress to make a law or some problem along those lines.
So when President Biden issued his executive order, for example, on preventing and combating discrimination on the basis of gender identity or sexual orientation, I know HUD is the first agency now to release directives on that order, which impacts privacy in public and school restrooms, dorm living arrangements on college campuses, and school sports. Is that kind of getting the cart before the horse? Is this executive order superseding any existing law?
Well, it claims to be based on the 1964 Civil Rights Act, which bans discrimination for a series of reasons. And by the way, the fact that the president is interpreting it this way is really important because that means that's how the executive branch is going to enforce it. I do think that it goes beyond what the words of the law meant, that when the law talks about discrimination based on sex, for example, it was thinking in more traditional terms of discrimination against biological males and females because of their being a man or a woman. And so I do think this goes beyond what the law intends, and that could obviously have big problems going forward for those Christian colleges. I will say, beyond whether they're interpreting it right or not, there will be the question for Christian colleges about the free exercise of religion and whether, even if President Biden's interpretation of this stands in general, whether there won't be protections for religious exemptions given to these kind of colleges. The Supreme Court will probably have to take up both of those questions as it attempts, as I said earlier, to do its job of resolving disputes about the law.
Yeah, we've seen 33 plaintiffs come together and sue the Department of Education, I believe in Washington State, saying that, hey, why can these Christian colleges get federal funding for financial aid if they basically stick to these biblical values because these students are claiming discrimination? And then I know that there was also a recent case where College of the Ozarks is suing the Biden administration because of gender identity and sexual orientation, what they deem as discrimination on college campuses and other places.
Yes, and you're right. The consequences in concrete terms for these colleges could be loss of accreditation, loss of tax-exempt status, loss of federal funds, which most colleges depend on as a part of their revenue. And I think going forward, what seems likely, at least in the courts, to be the future is the court has basically interpreted this law similar to the Biden administration in the Bostock case that came out last year. At the same time, that didn't resolve religious scruples, and the court has seemed to be fairly open to giving religious exemptions. So you might have a kind of bifurcated application of the law where it applies in one way to the general public, but that because of the First Amendment, there are some exceptions made for Christian colleges and others. We'll have to see, but that seems to be the way the court's trending in applying these kind of rules.
I'm confused about the law that this gender identity executive push is based on. And you said it goes back to the civil rights law, but I feel like that's the Equality Act, which hasn't been passed. It's currently in the Senate. It has passed the House.
Yeah, I do think this is an attempt to read the principles of the Equality Act back into the Civil Rights Act of 1964. But I think what has emboldened the Biden administration to do so is the Bostock case from 2020, where the court in some ways read principles similar to the Equality Act back into the 1964 Civil Rights Act, saying that discrimination on the basis of sex includes gender identity, not just the sex at biological birth. So that's where I think you're right. And in fact, the dissenters said, if the government wants to do this, they need to pass a new law, not reinterpret the old law in ways that it wasn't intended to function as. That's legislating. That's not interpreting or applying the law.
Thank you for that. Adam, is there a distinction between an executive order and an executive action besides words?
There is, although it gets really muddled. Generally, executive actions are a broad umbrella term for things the president does within his executive powers. And executive orders are direct applications of the law that carry the binding power of the executive branch. And some of the other things that presidents might do that might be considered executive actions might be, for example, proclamations. While sometimes proclamations look like executive orders, they don't always necessarily carry the force of law. So when the president announces a federal holiday for Thanksgiving, that may have the force of law in closing down a post office. But if the president in it asks people to pray or asks people to remember and be thankful, that's just a suggestion. It's not actually a forceful application of the law. And so executive orders are always applications of the law that are binding. Other things that the executive might do that are executive actions are not, but it can get kind of murky in the margins as far as people who use those terms very loosely in public discourse.
Thank you for that. Do you think that the attempt to add to the number of justices on the Supreme Court goes beyond the executive powers?
Strictly the executive power, yes, because the Constitution doesn't say how many justices there should be on the Supreme Court. That's set by law. That means that ultimately Congress is the one that passes laws to set the number of justices on the court. Now, I did say there are exceptions to the separation of powers. The president could be involved in signing or vetoing that law, but for the president to, under his executive power, unilaterally try to place the number of justices on the court would be beyond his power. He would have to only sign or veto something that Congress does.
Thank you, Adam. What else do you think our listeners need to know about the design of government, especially as others seek to do away with biblical values in the days ahead?
Well, I think the ultimate thing to remember is that the government is established by God. It is ultimately put there, and it's put there for certain purposes. And those purposes are understood, as our Declaration of Independence says, by the laws of nature and nature's God, and that as we're assessing what legitimate just governments are doing, we have to always keep in mind that the values of what it means to be a human being, what justice is, and how government protects the vulnerable and how the government ensures our natural rights ultimately come from those sources. It comes from God and the laws that God has put into place in creating the world. And I think that reassessing those and looking at current events in those lights is the best way to understand it, and for Christians to understand that God is ultimately the king, and that therefore we need to know that ultimately he is in control of history as we go forward. So that can be a comfort in the midst of what might be very challenging times ahead.
That's Hillsdale Professor Adam Carrington. I'm Tracy Lynn, Family Life News.